About you.
Lopwitz? When? Sherman found himself clutching at this rope of hope. Perhaps he had built up so many points in the past, the Giscard debacle would not finish him. And I know your father, too. Scared to death of him. With this, the woman gripped Sherman's forearm and fastened her eyes onto his and broke into an extraordinary laugh, a hacking laugh, not ha-ha-ha, but hack-hack-hack-hack-hack-hack-hack-hack-hack, a laugh of such heartiness and paroxysmal rapture that Sherman found himself grinning foolishly and saying, "You don't say."
"Yes? Hack-hack-hack-hack-hack-hack-hack. I never told you this, Judy."
She reached out and hooked one arm inside Judy's and the other inside Sherman's and pulled the two of them toward her, as if they were the two dearest chums she had ever had.
"There was this dreadful man named Durdurian who was suing Leon, kept trying to attach things. Pure harassment. So one weekend we were out on Santa Catalina Island at Angie Chivelli's."
She dropped the name of the famous comedian without so much as a syncopation. "And we're having dinner, and Leon starts talking about all the trouble he's having with this man Durdurian, and Angie says, believe me, he was absolutely serious. He says, 'You want me to take care of it?'" With this, Inez Bevardage pushed her nose to one side with her forefinger to indicate the bent-nose crowd. "Well, I mean, I'd heard about Angie and the boys, but I didn't believe it. But he was serious. Hack, 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 hack."
She pulled Sherman yet closer and put her eyes right in his face. "When Leon got back to New York, he went to see your father, and he told him what Angie had said, and then he said to your father, 'Maybe that's the simplest way to take care of it.' I'll never forget what your father said. He said, 'No, Mr. Bevardage, you let me take care of it. It won't be simple, it won't be fast, and it'll cost you a lot of money, but my bill you can pay. The other, no one is rich enough to pay them. They'll keep collecting until the day you die.'"
Inez Bevardage remained close to Sherman's face and gave him a look of bottomless profundity. He felt obliged to say something.
"Well, which did your husband do?" "What your father said, of course. When he spoke, people jumped."
A hack, 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 hacking peal of laughter.
"And what about the bill?"
asked Judy, as if delighted to be in on this story about Sherman's incomparable father.
"It was sensational. It was astonishing, that bill."
Hack, 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 hack. Vesuvius, Krakatoa, and Mauna Loa erupted with laughter, and Sherman felt himself swept up in the explosion in spite of himself. "It was irresistible. Jean Lopwitz loves you. Your incomparable father. Your aristocratic lineage. What euphoria you arouse in my bony breast." He knew it was irrational, but he felt warm, aglow, high, in seventh heaven. He eased the revolver of his resentment back into his waistband and told his snobbery to go lie down by the hearth. Really, a very charming woman. Who would have thought it after all the things one hears about the Bevardages? A social X-ray, to be sure, but one can't very well hold that against her. Really very warm and quite amusing. Like most men, Sherman was innocent of the routine salutatory techniques of the fashionable hostesses. For at least 45 seconds, every guest was the closest, dearest, jolliest, most wittily conspiratorial friend a girl ever had. Every male guest she touched on the arm, any other part of the body presented problems, and applied a little heartfelt pressure. Every guest, male or female, she looked at with a radar lock upon the eyes, as if captivated by the brilliance, the wit, the beauty, and the incomparable memories. The butler returned with the drinks for Judy and Sherman. Sherman took a long, deep draught of the gin and tonic, and the gin hit bottom, and the sweet juniper rose, and he relaxed, and let the happy buzz of the hive surge into his head. "Hack, hack, 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 hack," went Inez Bevardage. "Ha, ha, 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 ha," went Bobby Shafflett.
"Ha, ha, 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 ha,"
went Judy. "He, went Sherman. The hive buzzed and buzzed. In no time, Inez Bavardage had steered him and Judy over to the bouquet where the golden hillbilly held forth. Nods, hellos, handshakes, under the aegis of Sherman's new best friend, Inez. Before he quite realized what had happened, Inez had steered Judy out of the entry gallery into some inner salon, and Sherman was left with the celebrated Appalachian fat boy, two men, and an X-ray. He looked at each of them, starting with Shafflett. None returned his gaze. The two men and the woman stared, rapt, at the huge, pale head of the tenor as he recounted a story of something that had happened on an airplane.
"So I'm setting up Al, waiting for Barbara. She's supposed to be riding back to New York with me?"
He had a way of ending a declarative sentence with a question that reminded Sherman of Maria. Maria. And the huge Hasidic Jew. The great blonde ball of fat before him was like that huge sow from the real estate company, if that was where he was from. A cold tremor. They were out there circling, circling.
"And I'm in my seat. I got the one by the window, and from back air, here come this unbelievable, outrageous black man."
The way he hit the un and the out and fluttered his hands in the air made Sherman wonder if this hillbilly giant was in fact a homosexual.
"He's wearing this here ermine overcoat down to here, and this here matching ermine fedora, and he's got more rings than Barbara's got, and he's got three retainers with him right out of Shaft."
The giant bubbled on, and the two men and the woman kept their eyes on his huge round face and their grins fixed, and the giant, for his part, looked only at them, never at Sherman. As the seconds rolled by, he grew increasingly aware that all four of them were acting as if he didn't exist. A giant fairy with a hillbilly accent, thought Sherman, and they were hanging on his every word. Sherman took three deep gulps of his gin and tonic. The story seemed to revolve about the fact that the regal black man, who had sat down next to Shafflett on the airplane, was the cruiserweight champion of the world, Sam, Assassin Sam, Asinor. Shafflett found the term cruiserweight vastly amusing, ha 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 ha, and the two men went into excited screams of laughter. Sherman labeled them homosexual, too. Assassin Sam hadn't known who Shafflett was, and Shafflett hadn't known who Assassin Sam was. The point of the entire story seemed to be that the only two people in the first-class section of the airliner who hadn't known who both these celebrities were Shafflett and Asinor themselves. Ha 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 ha, he 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 he, and aha! A conversational nugget about Assassin Sam Asinor popped into Sherman's brain. Oscar Suter, Oscar Suter. He winced at the memory but pressed on. Oscar Suter was part of a syndicate of Midwestern investors who backed Asinor and controlled his finances. A nugget, a conversational nugget, a means of entry into this party cluster. As soon as the laughter had receded, Sherman said to Bobby Shafflett, "Did you know that Asinor's contract and his ermine coat, for all I know, is owned by a syndicate of businessmen in Ohio, mostly from Cleveland and Columbus?" The golden hillbilly looked at him as if he were a panhandler. He said. It was the that says, "I understand, but I couldn't care less." Whereupon he turned back to the other three and said,
"So I asked him if he'd sign my menu. You know, they give you this menu, and—"
That was all for Sherman McCoy. He pulled the revolver of resentment back out of his waistband. He wheeled away from the cluster and turned his back on them. Not one of them noticed. The hive raged in his head. Now what would he do? All at once he was alone in this noisy hive with no place to roost. Alone. He became acutely aware that the entire party was now composed of these bouquets, and that not to be in one of them was to be an abject, incompetent social failure.
He looked this way and that. Who was that right there? A tall, handsome, smug-looking man, admiring faces looking up at his. Ah, it registered, an author. His name was Nunnally Void, a novelist. He'd seen him on a television talk show, snide, acerbic. Look at the way those fools doted on him. Didn't dare try that bouquet. Would be a repeat of the Golden Hillbilly, no doubt. Over there, someone he knew. No, another famous face, the ballet dancer, Boris Korolev. Another circle of adoring faces, glistening with rapture. The idiots, human specks. What is this business of groveling before dancers, novelists, and gigantic fairy opera singers? They're nothing but court jesters, nothing but light entertainment for the masters of the universe, those who push the levers that move the world. And yet these idiots worship them as if they were pipelines to the Godhead. They didn't even want to know who he was, and wouldn't even be capable of understanding, even if they had. He found himself standing by another cluster. Well, at least no one famous in this one, no smirking court jester. A fat reddish man was talking in a heavy British accent.
He was lying in the road, you see, with a broken leg.
The delicate skinny boy, Henry Lamb. He was talking about the story in the newspaper. But wait a minute. A broken leg.
And he kept saying, "How very boring, how very boring."
No, he was talking about some Englishman, nothing to do with me. The others in the cluster were laughing, a woman about 50 with pink powder all over her face. How grotesque. Wait. He knew that face. The sculptor's daughter, now a stage designer. He couldn't remember her name. But then he did. Barbara Cornaglia. He moved on. Alone. Despite all, despite the fact that they were circling, the police, he felt the pressure of social failure. What could he do to make it appear as if he meant to be by himself, as if he were moving through the hive alone, by choice? The hive buzzed and buzzed. Near the doorway through which Judy and Inez Bevardage had disappeared was an antique console bearing a pair of miniature Chinese easels. Upon each easel was a burgundy velvet disc the size of a pie, and in slits in the velvet, little pockets, were stuck name cards. They were models of the seating arrangement for dinner, so that each guest would know who his dinner partners were going to be. It struck Sherman, the leonine Yale man, as another piece of vulgarity. Nevertheless, he looked. It was a way of appearing occupied, as if he were alone for no other reason than to study the seating arrangement. There were evidently two tables. Presently he saw a card with Mr. McCoy on it. He would be sitting next to, let's see, a Mrs. Rothroat, whoever she might be, and a Mrs. Ruskin. Ruskin? His heart bolted. It couldn't be. Not Maria. But, of course, it could be. This was precisely the sort of event to which she and her rich but somewhat shadowy husband would be invited. He downed the rest of his gin and tonic and hurried through the doorway into the other room. Maria had to talk to her, but also had to keep Judy away from her. Don't need that on top of everything else. He was now in the apartment's living room, or salon, since it was obviously meant for entertaining. It was enormous, but it appeared to be stuffed with sofas, cushions, fat chairs, and hassocks, all of them braided, tasseled, banded, bordered, and stuffed. Even the walls. The walls were covered in some sort of padded fabric with stripes of red, purple, and rose. The windows overlooking Fifth Avenue were curtained in deep folds of the same material, which was pulled back to reveal its rose lining and a trim of striped rope braid. There was not so much as a hint of the 20th century in the decor, not even in the lighting. A few table lamps with rosy shades provided all the light, so that the terrain of this gloriously stuffed little planet was thrown into deep shadows and mellow highlights. The hive buzzed with the sheer ecstasy of being in this mellow, rosy, stuffed orbit.
Hack, 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 hack.
The hoarse laugh of Inez Bavardage rose somewhere. So many bouquets of people, grinning faces, boiling teeth. A butler appeared and asked him if he wanted a drink. He ordered another gin and tonic. He stood there. His eyes jumped around the deep stuffed shadows. Maria. She was standing by one of the two corner windows, bare shoulders, a red sheath. She caught his eye and smiled. Just that, a smile. He answered with the smallest smile imaginable. Where was Judy? In Maria's cluster was a woman he didn't recognize, a man he didn't recognize, and a bald-headed man he knew from somewhere, another of the famous faces this zoo specialized in, a writer of some sort, a Brit. He couldn't think of his name. Completely bald, not a hair on his long, thin head, gaunt, a skull. Sherman panned the room, desperately searching for Judy. Well, what difference would it make if Judy did meet someone in this room named Maria? It wasn't that unusual a name. But would Maria be discreet? She was no genius, and she had a mischievous streak, and he was supposed to sit next to her. He could feel his heart kicking up in his chest. Christ, was it possible that Inez Bavardage knew about the two of them and put them together on purpose? Wait a minute. That's very paranoid. She'd never risk having an ugly scene. Still, Judy. There she was, standing over near the fireplace, laughing so hard, her new party laugh, wants to be an Inez Bavardage, laughing so hard her hair was bouncing. She was making a new sound. Hawk, 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 hawk. Not yet Inez Bavardage's hack, 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 just an intermediary hawk, 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 hawk. She was listening to a barrel-chested old man with receding gray hair and no neck. The third member of the bouquet, a woman, elegant, slim, and 40-ish, was not nearly so amused. She stood like a marble angel. Sherman made his way through the hive, past the knees of some people sitting down on a huge round oriental hassock, toward the fireplace. He had to push his way through a dense flotilla of puffed gowns and boiling faces. Judy's face was a mask of mirth. She was so enthralled by the conversation of the barrel-chested man she didn't notice Sherman at first. Then she saw him, startled. But of course, it was a sign of social failure for one spouse to be reduced to joining another in a conversational cluster. But so what? Keep her away from Maria. That was the main thing. Judy didn't look at him. Once again, she beamed her grinning rapture at the old man.
So last week, he was saying, my wife comes back from Italy and informs me we have a summer place on Como. Como? She says, it's this Lake Como, so all right, we'll have a summer place on Como. It's better than Hammamet. That was two summers ago.
He had a rough voice, a brushed-up New York street voice. He was holding a glass of soda water and looking back and forth from Judy to the Marble Angel, as he told his story, getting vast effusions of approval from Judy and the occasional wriggle of the upper lip when he looked directly into the angel's face. A wriggle. It could have been the beginning of a polite smile.
At least I know where Como is. I never heard of Hammamet. My wife's gone gaga about Italy. Italian paintings, Italian clothes, and now Como.
Judy went off into another automatic weapon burst of laughter. Hawk, 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 hawk. As if the way the old man pronounced Como, in mockery of his wife's love of things Italian, was the funniest thing in the world. Maria. It came over him, just like that. It was Maria he was talking about. This old man was her husband, Arthur Ruskin. Had he mentioned her by name yet, or had he been talking only about my wife? The other woman, Marble Angel, just stood there. The old man suddenly reached toward her left ear and took her earring between his thumb and forefinger. Appalled, the woman stiffened. She would have jerked her head away, but her ear was now between the thumb and forefinger of this ancient and appalling ursine creature.
"Very nice,"
said Arthur Ruskin, still holding onto the earring. Nadina D., right? Nadina Dolochi was a highly mentionable jewelry designer.
I believe so,
said the woman in a timorous European voice. Hurriedly, she brought her hands to her ears and unfastened both earrings and handed them to him, most emphatically, as if to say, "There, take them, but be so kind as not to rip my ears off my head." Unconcerned, Ruskin took them in his hairy paws and inspected them further.
"Nadina D., all right. Very nice. Where'd you get them?"
"They were a gift."
Cold as marble. He returned them to her, and she quickly put them in her purse.
"Very nice, very nice. My wife."
"Suppose he said Maria," Sherman broke in. "Judy," to the others, "excuse me, to Judy. I was wondering." Judy instantly transformed her startled expression into one of radiance. No wife in all of history had ever been more charmed to see her husband arrive at a conversational bouquet.
"Sherman, have you met Madame Prudhomme?"
Sherman extended his Yale chin and put on an expression of the most proper Knickerbocker charm to greet the shaken Frenchwoman.
"How'd you do?"
"And Arthur Ruskin?" said Judy. Sherman shook the hairy mitt firmly. Arthur Ruskin was a not young 71. He had big ears with thick rinds and wire hairs sprouting out. There were curdled wattles under his big jaws. He stood erectly, rocking back on his heels, which brought out his chest and his ponderous gut. His heft was properly swathed in a navy suit, white shirt, and navy tie.
"Forgive me," said Sherman, to Judy with a charming smile. "Come over here a moment."
To Ruskin and the Frenchwoman he flashed a smile of apology and moved off a few feet, Judy in tow. Madame Prudhomme's face fell. She had looked to his arrival in the bouquet as a salvation from Ruskin. Judy, with a fireproof smile still on her face,
"What is it?"
Sherman, a smiling mask of Yale chin charm, "I want you to come meet Baron Hoxwald."
"Who?"
"Baron Hoxwald, you know, the German, one of the Hoxwalds." Judy, the smile still locked on,
"But why?"
"We rode up in the elevator with him." This obviously made no sense to Judy at all. Urgently,
"Well, where is he?"
Urgently, because it was bad enough to be caught in a large conversational cluster with your husband, to form a minimal cluster with him, just the two of you. Sherman, looking around, "Well, he was here just a minute ago." Judy, the smile gone,
"Sherman, what on earth are you doing? What are you talking about, Baron Hoxwald?"
Just then the butler arrived with Sherman's gin and tonic. He took a big swallow and looked around some more. He felt dizzy. Everywhere, social x-rays and puffed dresses shimmering in the burnt apricot glow of the little table lamps.
"Well, you two, what are you trying to cook up?"
"Hack, hack, 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 hack." Inez Bevardage took them both by their arms. For a moment, before she could get her fireproof grin back onto her face, Judy looked stricken. Not only had she ended up in a minimal cluster with her husband, but New York's reigning hostess, this month's ringmistress of the century, had spotted them and felt compelled to make this ambulance run to save them from social ignominy.
Sherman was, "I was looking for you. I want you to meet Ronald Vine. He's doing over the vice president's house in Washington."
Inez Bevardage towed them through the hive of grins and gowns and inserted them in a bouquet dominated by a tall, slender, handsome, youngish man, the aforesaid Ronald Vine. Mr. Vine was saying,
"Jabots, jabots, jabots. I'm afraid the vice president's wife has discovered jabots."
A weary roll of the eyes. The others in the bouquet, two women and a bald man, laughed and laughed. Judy could barely summon up even a smile. Crushed. Had to be rescued from social death by the hostess. Such sad irony. Sherman hated himself. He hated himself for all the catastrophes she didn't yet know about. The Bevardage's dining room walls had been painted with so many coats of burnt apricot lacquer, 14 in all, they had the glassy brilliance of a pond reflecting a campfire at night. The room was a triumph of nocturnal reflections, one of many such victories by Ronald Vine, whose fort was the creation of glitter without the use of mirrors. Mirror indigestion was now regarded as one of the gross sins of the 1970s. So, in the early 1980s, from Park Avenue to Fifth, from 62nd Street to 96th, there had arisen the hideous cracking sound of acres of hellishly expensive plate glass mirror being pried off the walls of the great apartments. No, in the Bevardage's dining room, one's eyes fluttered in a cosmos of glints, twinkles, sparkles, highlights, sheens, shimmering pools, and fiery glows that had been achieved in subtler ways by using lacquer, glazed tiles in a narrow band just under the ceiling cornices, gilded English Regency furniture, silver candelabra, crystal bowls, School of Tiffany vases, and sculpted silverware that was so heavy the knives weighed on your fingers like saber handles. The 24 diners were seated at a pair of round Regency tables, the banquet table, the sort of Sheraton landing field that could seat 24 if you inserted all the leaves, had disappeared from the smarter dining rooms. One shouldn't be so formal, so grand. Two small tables were much better. So what if these two small tables were surrounded and bedecked by a build-up of objets, fabrics, and bibelots so lush it would have made the Sun King blink? Hostesses such as Inez Bevardage prided themselves on their gift for the informal and the intimate. To underscore the informality of the occasion, there had been placed in the middle of each table, deep within the forest of crystal and silver, a basket woven from hardened vines in a highly rustic Appalachian handicrafts manner. Wrapped around the vines on the outside of the basket was a profusion of wildflowers. In the center of the basket were massed 3 or 4 dozen poppies. This faux-naïf centerpiece was the trademark of Huck Thigg, the young florist, who would present the Bevardages with a bill for $3,300 for this one dinner party. Sherman stared at the plaited vines. They looked like something dropped by Gretel or little Heidi of Switzerland at a feast of Lucullus. He sighed. All too much. Maria was sitting next to him, on his right, chattering away at the cadaverous Englishman, whatever his name was, who was on her right. Judy was at the other table, but had a clear view of him and Maria. He had to talk to Maria about the interrogation by the two detectives, but how could he do it with Judy looking right at them? He'd do it with an innocuous party grin on his face. That was it. He'd grin through the whole discussion. She'd never know the difference. Or would she? Arthur Ruskin was at Judy's table, but thank God he was 4 seats away from her, wouldn't be chatting with her. Judy was sitting between Baron Hoxvald and some rather pompous-looking youngish man. Inez Bevardage was 2 seats away from Judy, and Bobby Shafflett was on Inez's right. Judy was grinning an enormous social grin at the pompous man. Hock, 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 hock. Clear above the buzz of the hive, he could hear her laughing her new laugh. Inez was talking to Bobby Shafflett, but also to the grinning social X-ray seated to the golden hillbilly's right, and to Nunnally Void, who was to the right of the X-ray. Ha 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 ha, sang the tow-headed tenor. Hack 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 hack, sang Inez Bevardage. Hock 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 hock, bawled his own wife. Leon Bevardage sat 4 chairs to Sherman's right, beyond Maria, the cadaverous Englishman, and the woman with the pink powder on her face, Barbara Cornaglia. In contrast to Inez Bevardage, Leon had all the animation of a raindrop. He had a placid, passive, lineless face, wavy blondish hair, which was receding, a long, delicate nose, and very pale, almost livid skin. Instead of a 300-watt social grin, he had a shy, demure smile, which he was just now bestowing upon Miss Cornaglia. Belatedly, it occurred to Sherman that he should be talking to the woman on his left, Rothrode, Mrs. Rothrode. Who in the name of God was she? What could he say to her?
He turned to his left. And she was waiting. She was staring straight at him, her laser eyes no more than 18 inches from his face, a real X-ray with a huge mane of blonde hair and a look of such intensity he thought at first that she must know something. He opened his mouth. He smiled. He ransacked his brain for something to say. He did the best he could. He said to her, "Would you do me a great favor? What is the name of the gentleman to my right, the thin gentleman? His face is so familiar, but I can't think of his name for the life of me." Mrs. Rothroat leaned still closer until their faces were barely 8 inches apart. She was so close, she seemed to have three eyes.
"Aubrey Buffing," she said.
Her eyes kept burning into his. "Aubrey Buffing," said Sherman lamely. It was really a question.
"The poet," said Mrs. Rothroat. "He's on the short list for the Nobel Prize. His father was the Duke of Bray," her tone said. "How on earth could you not know that?"
"Of course," said Sherman, feeling that in addition to his other sins, he was also a Philistine. "The poet.
How do you think he looks?"
She had eyes like a cobra's. Her face remained right in his. He wanted to pull back, but couldn't. He felt paralyzed.
"Looks?" he asked.
"Lord Buffing," she said. "The state of his health."
"I can't really say. I don't know him."
"He's being treated at Vanderbilt Hospital." "He has AIDS."
She pulled back a few inches, the better to see how this zinger hit Sherman. "That's terrible," said Sherman. "How do you know that?"
"I know his best boyfriend."
She closed her eyes and then opened them as if to say, "I know such things, but don't ask too many questions." Then she said,
"This is entre nous.
But I've never met you before."
"Don't tell Leon or Inez," she continued. "He's their house guest, has been for the past 2.5 weeks. Never invite an Englishman for a weekend. You can't get them out."
She said this without smiling, as if it was the most serious advice she had ever offered free of charge. She continued her myopic study of Sherman's face. In order to break eye contact, Sherman took a quick glance at the gaunt Englishman, Lord Buffing, the shortlist poet.
"Don't worry," said Mrs. Rothroat. "You can't get it at the table. If you could, we'd all have it by now. Half the waiters in New York are gay. You show me a happy homosexual, I'll show you a gay corpse."
She repeated this mot farouche in the same rat-tat-tat voice as everything else, without a trace of a smile. Just then, a good-looking young waiter, Latin in appearance, began serving the first course, which looked like an Easter egg under a heavy white sauce on a plateau of red caviar resting on a bed of bib lettuce.
"Not these," said Mrs. Rothroat, right in front of the young man. "They work full-time for Inez and Leon, Mexicans from New Orleans. They live in their place in the country and drive in to serve dinner parties."
Then, without any preamble, she said,
"What do you do, Mr. McCoy?"
Sherman was taken aback. He was speechless. He was as flabbergasted as he had been when Campbell asked the same question. A non-entity, a 35-year-old X-ray, and yet, "I want to impress her." The possible answers came thundering through his mind. "I'm a senior member of the Bond Division at Pierce & Pierce." No. Makes it sound as if he's a replaceable part in a bureaucracy and proud to be one. "I'm the number one producer." No. Sounds like something a vacuum cleaner salesman would say. "There's a group of us who make the major decisions." No. Not accurate. And an utterly gauche observation. "I made $980,000 selling bonds last year." That was the true heart of the matter, but there was no way to impart such information without appearing foolish. "I'm a master of the universe." Dream on. And besides, there's no way to utter it. So he said, "Oh, I try to sell a few bonds for Pierce & Pierce." He smiled ever so slightly, hoping the modesty of the statement would be taken as a sign of confidence to Byrne, thanks to tremendous and spectacular achievements on Wall Street. Mrs. Rothroat lasered in on him again, from 6 inches away.
Jean Lapwitz is one of our clients.
Your client?
At Benning and Sturdivant.
Where? He stared at her.
You do know Jean, she said.
Well, yes, I work with him.
Evidently, the woman did not find that convincing. To Sherman's astonishment, she turned 90 degrees without another word to her left, where a jolly, florid, red-faced man was talking to the lemon tart who had arrived with Baron Huxwald. Sherman now realized who he was, a television executive named Rail Brigham. Sherman stared at Mrs. Rothroat's bony vertebrae, where they popped up from out of her gown. Perhaps she had turned away for only a moment and would turn back to resume their conversation. But no. She had barged in on the conversation of Brigham and the tart. He could hear her rat-tat-tat voice. She was leaning in on Brigham, lasering in. She had devoted all the time she cared to devote to a mere bond salesman. He was stranded again. To his right, Maria was still deep in conversation with Lord Buffing. He was facing social death once more. He was a man sitting utterly solo at a dinner table.
The hive buzzed all around him. Everyone else was in a state of social bliss. Only he was stranded.
Only he was a wallflower with no conversational mate, a social light of no wattage whatsoever in the Bavardage celebrity zoo.
My life is coming apart.
And yet through everything else in his overloaded central nervous system burned the shame of social incompetence. He stared at Huck Figg's hardened vines in the center of the table, as if a student of floral arrangements. Then he put a smirk on his face, as if confidently amused. He took a deep gulp of wine and looked across to the other table. As if he had caught the eye of someone there, he smiled. He murmured soundlessly toward vacant spots on the wall. He drank some more wine and studied the hardened vines some more. He counted the vertebrae in Mrs. Rothroat's backbone. He was happy when one of the waiters, one of the Varones from the country, materialized and refilled his glass of wine. The main course consisted of slices of pink roast beef, brought in on huge china platters, with ruffs of stewed onions, carrots, and potatoes. It was a simple, hearty American main course. Simple, hearty American main courses, insinuated between exotically contrived prologues and epilogues, were comme il faut, currently, in keeping with the informal mode. When the Mexican waiter began hoisting the huge platters over the shoulders of the diners so that they could take what they wanted, that served as the signal to change conversational partners. Lord Buffing, the stricken English poet entre nous, turned toward the powdered Madame Cornaglia. Maria turned toward Sherman. She smiled and looked deeply into his eyes. Too deeply. Suppose Judy should look at them right now. He put on a frozen social grin.
"Phew," said Maria.
She rolled her eyes in the direction of Lord Buffing. Sherman didn't want to talk about Lord Buffing. He wanted to talk about the visit from the two detectives. But best start off slowly, in case Judy is looking.
"Ah, that's right," he said, a great social grin. "I forgot. You don't care for Brits."
"Oh, it's not that," said Maria. "He seems like a nice man. I could hardly understand what he was saying. You never heard such an accent."
Social grin. "What did he talk about?"
"The purpose of life."
"I'm not kidding." Social grin. "Did he happen to mention what it is?"
"As a matter of fact, he did. Reproduction."
Social grin. "Reproduction?"
"Yes. He said it had taken him 70 years to realize that's the sole purpose of life, reproduction. Said nature is concerned with but one thing, reproduction for the sake of reproduction."
Social grin. "That's very interesting, coming from him. You know he's homosexual, don't you?"
"Oh, come on. Who told you that?"
"This one." He gestured toward the back of Mrs. Rothroat. "Who is she, anyhow? Do you know her?"
"Yeah, Sally Rothroat. She's a real estate broker."
Social grin. "A real estate broker?
Dear God, who on earth would invite a real estate broker to dinner? As if reading his mind, Maria said,
"You're behind the times, Sherman. Real estate brokers are very chic now. She goes everywhere with that old red-faced tub over there, Lord Gut."
She nodded toward the other table.
"The fat man with the British accent?"
"Yes."
"Who is he?"
"Some banker or other." Social grin. "I've got something to tell you, Maria, but I don't want you to get excited. My wife is at the next table and she's facing us, so please be cool."
"Well, well, well. Why, Mr. McCoy, honey."
Keeping the social grin clamped on his mug the whole time, Sherman gave her a quick account of his confrontation with the two policemen. Just as he feared, Maria's composure broke. She shook her head and scowled.
"Well, why didn't you let 'em see the goddamn car, Sherman? You said it's clean."
Social grin.
"Hey, calm down. My wife may be looking. I wasn't worried about the car. I just didn't want them to talk to the attendant. It may be the same one who was there that night when I brought the car back."
"Jesus Christ, Sherman, you talk to me about being cool, and you're so uncool. You sure you didn't tell him anything?"
Social grin.
"Yes, I'm sure."
"For Christ's sake, get that stupid smile off your face. You're allowed to have a serious conversation with a girl at the dinner table, even if your wife is looking. I don't know why you agreed to talk to the goddamn police in the first place.
It seemed like the right thing to do at the time."
"I told you you weren't cut out for this."
Clamping the social grin back on, Sherman glanced at Judy. She was busy grinning toward the Indian face of Baron Huxvald. He turned back to Maria, still grinning.
"Oh, for God's sake," said Maria.
He turned off the grin. "When can I talk to you? When can I see you?"
"Call me tomorrow night."
"Okay, tomorrow night. Let me ask you something. Have you heard anybody talking about the story in the City Light? Anybody here tonight?" Maria started laughing. Sherman was glad. If Judy was watching, it would appear they were having an amusing conversation.
"Are you serious?" said Maria. "The only thing these people read in the City Light is her column."
She motioned toward a large woman across the table, a woman of a certain age, with an outrageous mop of blonde hair and false eyelashes so long and thick she could barely lift her upper lids. Social grin. "Who's that?"
"That's the Shadow."
Sherman's heart kicked up.
"You're joking. They invite a newspaper columnist to dinner?"
"Sure. Don't worry. She isn't interested in you, and she isn't interested in automobile accidents in the Bronx either. If I shot Arthur, she'd be interested in that. And I'd be glad to oblige her."
Maria launched into a denunciation of her husband. He was consumed with jealousies and resentments. He was making her life hell. He kept calling her a whore. Her face was becoming more and more contorted. Sherman was alarmed. Judy might be looking. He wanted to put his social grin back on, but how could he, in the face of this lamentation?
"I mean, he goes around the apartment calling me a whore. You whore! You whore!" Right in front of the servants. "How do you think that feels? If he calls me that one more time, I'm going to hit him over the head with something. I swear to God."
Out of the corner of his eye, Sherman could see Judy's face turned toward the two of them. Oh, Christ! And him without his grin on. Quickly, he retrieved it and clamped it on his face and said to Maria,
"That's terrible. It sounds like he's senile."
Maria stared at his pleasant social visage for a moment, then shook her head.
"Go to hell, Sherman. You're as bad as he is."
Startled, Sherman kept the grin on and let the sound of the hive engulf him. Such ecstasy on all sides, such radiant eyes and fireproof grins, so many boiling teeth.
"Hack, hack, 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 hack."
Inez Beverdage's laugh rose in social triumph.
"Ha, ha, 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 ha."
The golden hillbilly's barnyard bray rose in response. Sherman gulped down another glass of wine. The dessert was apricot souffle, prepared individually for each diner in a stout little crock of the Normandy sort, with borders au restaud, painted by hand near the rim. Rich desserts were back in fashion this season.
the sort of dessert that showed you were conscious of calories and cholesterol, all the berries and melon balls with dollops of sherbet, had become just a bit middle America. On top of that, to be able to serve 24 individual soufflés was a tour de force. It required quite a kitchen and a staff and a half. Once the tour de force had run its course, Leon Bavardage rose to his feet and tapped on his wine glass. A glass of Sauterne, of a deep rosy golden hue. Heavy dessert wines were also comme il faut this season, and was answered by the happy, drunken percussion of people at both tables tapping their wine glasses in a risery fashion.
Ha 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 ha!
Bobby Shafflett's laugh rang out. He was banging his glass for all he was worth. Leon Bavardage's red lips spread across his face, and his eyes crinkled, as if the crystal percussion was a great tribute to the joy the assembled celebrities found in his home.
"You are all such dear and special friends of Inez's and mine that we don't need a special occasion to want to have you all around us in our home," he said in a bland, slightly feminine, Gulf Coast drawl.
Then he turned toward the other table, where Bobby Shafflett sat.
"I mean, sometimes we ask Bobby to come over just so we can listen to his laugh. Bobby's laugh is music, far as I'm concerned. Besides, we never can get him to sing for us, even when Inez plays the piano."
"Hack, hack, 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 hack," went Inez Bavardage.
"Ha, ha, 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 ha,"
the golden hillbilly drowned her out with a laugh of his own. It was an amazing laugh, this one. It rose and rose and rose, and then it began to fall in a curious, highly stylized way, and then it broke into a sob. The room froze, dead silence, for that instant it took the diners, or most of them, to realize they had just heard the famous laughing sob of the Vesti la Giuba aria from Pagliacci. Tremendous applause from both tables, beaming grins, laughter, and cries of "More, more, more!" "Aw, naw," said the great blonde giant.
"I only sing for my supper, and that's enough for supper right there. My souffle wasn't big enough, Leon."
Storms of laughter, more applause. Leon Bavardage motioned languidly toward one of the Mexican waiters.
"More souffle for Mr. Shafflett," he said. "Make it in the bathtub."
The waiter stared back with a face of stone. Grinning, eyes glistening, swept up by this duet of the great wits, Rail Brigham yelled out,
"Bootleg souffle!"
This was so lame, Sherman was pleased to note that everyone ignored it, even the ray-eyed Mrs. Rothroat.
"But this is a special occasion all the same," said Leon Bavardage, "because we have a very special friend as our guest during his visit to the United States, Aubrey Buffing."
He beamed toward the great man, who turned his gaunt face toward Leon Bavardage with a small, tight, wary smile.
"Now, last year our friend Jacques Prudhomme,"
he beamed toward the French Minister of Culture, who was to his right, "told Inez and me he had it on good authority. I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, Jacques."
"I hope so, too,"
said the Minister of Culture in his grave voice, shrugging in an exaggerated fashion for humorous effect. Appreciative laughter.
"Well, you did tell Inez and me you had it on good authority that Aubrey had won the Nobel Prize. I'm sorry, Jacques, but your intelligence operations are not so hot in Stockholm."
Another grand shrug, more of the elegant, sepulchral voice.
"Fortunately, we do not contemplate hostilities with Sweden, Leon."
Great laughter.
"But Aubrey was that close anyway,"
said Leon, putting his forefinger and thumb close together.
"And next year may be his year."
The old Englishman's small, tight smile didn't budge.
"But of course, it really doesn't matter, because what Aubrey means to our culture goes way beyond prizes. And I know that what Aubrey means to Inez and me as a friend, well, it goes beyond prizes and culture, and—"
He was stumped for a way to finish off his tricolon, and so he said,
"And everything else. Anyway, I want to propose a toast to Aubrey, with best wishes for his visit to America."
He just bought himself another month of house guest,
Mrs. Rothroat said to Rail Brigham in a stage whisper. Leon lifted his glass of Sauterne.
Lord Buffing.
Raised glasses, applause, British style, hear-hears. The Englishman rose slowly to his feet. He was terribly haggard. His nose seemed a mile long. He was not tall, and yet somehow his great hairless skull made him seem imposing.
"You're much too kind, Leon,"
he said, looking at Leon and then casting his eyes down modestly.
"As you may know, anyone who entertains the notion of the Nobel Prize is advised to act as if he is oblivious of its very existence. And in any case, I'm far too old to worry about it, and so I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about."
Light, puzzled laughter.
"But one can scarcely help being aware of the marvelous friendship and hospitality of you and Inez, and thank goodness I don't have to pretend for a moment to be otherwise."
The Lightities had now trebled so rapidly the company was baffled, but they murmured their encouragement.
"So much so," he went on, "that I, for one, should be happy to sing for my supper."
"I should think so," whispered Mrs. Rothroat.
"But I don't see how anyone would dare to do so after Mr. Chafflet's remarkable allusion to Canio's grief in Pagliacci."
As only the English can do it, he pronounced Mr. Chafflet very archly, to bring out the ludicrous aspect of giving the dignified title Mr. to this rustic clown. Suddenly he stopped and lifted his head, and gazed straight ahead, as if looking through the walls of the building and out upon the metropolis beyond. He laughed dryly.
"Forgive me. All at once I was hearing the sound of my own voice, and it occurred to me that I now have the sort of British voice which, had I heard it half a century ago when I was a young man, a delightfully hot-headed young man, as I recall, would have caused me to leave the room."
People cut glances at one another.
"But I know you won't leave," Buffing continued. "It has always been wonderful to be an Englishman in the United States. Lord Gut may disagree with me."
He pronounced gut with such a guttural bark, it was as if he were saying Lord Shithead.
"But I doubt that he will. When I first came to the United States as a young man, before the Second Great War, and people heard my voice, they would say, 'Oh, you're English,' and I always got my way because they were so impressed. Nowadays, when I come to the United States and people hear my voice, they say, 'Oh, you're English, you poor thing.' And I still get my way, because your countrymen never fail to take pity on us."
Much appreciative laughter and relief. The old man was mining the lighter vein. He paused again, as if trying to decide whether he should go on or not. His conclusion, evidently, was yes.
"Why I've never written a poem about the States, I really don't know. Well, I take that back. I do know, of course. I have lived in a century in which poets are not supposed to write poems about anything, at least not anything you can put a geographical name to. But the United States deserve an epic poem. At various times in my career I considered writing an epic, but I didn't do that either. Poets are also not supposed to write epics any longer, despite the fact that the only poets who have endured and will endure are poets who have written epics. Homer, Virgil, Dante, Shakespeare, Milton, Spencer. Where will Mr. Eliot or Mr. Rimbaud,
pronounced like Mr. Chafflet,
be in their light even 25 years from now? In the shadows, I'm afraid. In the footnotes. Deep in the Ibid thickets. Along with Aubrey Buffing, and a lot of other poets I have thought very highly of from time to time. No, we poets no longer even have the vitality to write epics. We don't even have the courage to make rhymes,
and the American epic should have rhymes. Rhyme on top of rhyme in a shameless cascade, rhymes of the sort that Edgar Allan Poe gave us. Yes, Poe, who lived his last years just north of here, I believe, in a part of New York called the Bronx, in a little cottage with lilacs and a cherry tree, and a wife dying of tuberculosis. A drunk he was, of course, perhaps a psychotic, but with the madness of prophetic vision. He wrote a story that tells all we need to know about the moment we live in now, the Mask of the Red Death. A mysterious plague, the Red Death, is ravaging the land. Prince Prospero, Prince Prospero, even the name is perfect. Prince Prospero assembles all the best people in his castle and lays in 2 years' provision of food and drink and shuts the gates against the outside world, against the virulence of all lesser souls, and commences a masked ball that is to last until the plague has burnt itself out beyond the walls. The party is endless and seamless, and it takes place in 7 grand salons, and in each the revel becomes more intense than in the one before, and the revelers are drawn on toward the 7th room, which is appointed entirely in black. One night, in this last room, appears a guest shrouded in the most clever and most hideously beautiful costume this company of luminous masqueraders has ever seen. This guest is dressed as Death, but so convincingly that Prospero is offended and orders him ejected. But none dares touch him, so that the task is left to the prince himself, and the moment he touches the ghastly shroud, he falls down dead. For the Red Death has entered the house of Prospero. Prospero, my friends. Now, the exquisite part of the story is that somehow the guests have known all along what awaits them in this room, and yet they are drawn irresistibly toward it. Because the excitement is so intense, and the pleasure is so unbridled, and the gowns, and the food, and the drink, and the flesh are so sumptuous. And that is all they have. Families, homes, children, the great chain of being, the eternal tide of chromosomes mean nothing to them any longer. They are bound together, and they whirl about one another endlessly, particles in a doomed atom. And what else could the Red Death be but some sort of final stimulation? The ne plus autre. So Poe was kind enough to write the ending for us more than 100 years ago. Knowing that, who can possibly write all the sunnier passages that should come before? Not I. Not I. The sickness, the nausea, the pitiless pain have ceased with the fever that maddened my brain, with the fever called living, that burned in my brain, the fever called living. Those were among the last words he wrote. No, I cannot be the epic poet you deserve. I am too old and far too tired, too weary of the fever called living, and I value your company too much, your company and the world, the world, the world. Thank you, Leon. Thank you, Inez.
And with that, the spectral Englishman slowly took his seat. The intruder, the Beverdages dreaded most, silence, now commanded the room. The diners looked at one another in embarrassment, 3 kinds of it. They were embarrassed for this old man, who had committed the gaffe of injecting a somber note into an evening at the Beverdages. They were embarrassed because they felt the need to express their cynical superiority to his solemnity, but they didn't know how to go about it. Dared they snigger? After all, he was Lord Buffing of the Nobel shortlist and their host's house guest. And they were embarrassed because there was always the possibility that the old man had said something profound, and they had failed to get it. Sally Rothroat, rolled her eyes and pulled a mock-long face and looked about to see if anyone was following her lead. Lord Gut put a downcast smile on his great fat face and glanced at Bobby Shafflett, who was himself looking at Inez Beverdage for a clue. She offered none. She stared, dumbstruck. Judy was smiling an entire